So this past Monday in our country was Inauguration Day, where we saw an outgoing president and an incoming president. There is plenty of opinions and debates and emotions around a day like that, but I want to talk actually about something for a second that's more behind the scenes that we may or may not know happens on Inauguration Day. And even when it comes every 4 years, we get all caught up, or some of us get caught up in the hype of it and may not think about just the logistical things that have to happen on a day like that. Regardless of who the president is, there is a ton of work for the White House resident staff to do on that day, on that transition, as one president and his family leaves and a new president and his family comes in. As they move everything out from the past 4 years, or at the most 8 years of a person, and bring everything in for a new family. And this is not just, I watched some different things on this week and read some different things about it. It was really interesting. This is not just boxes that you're moving out of clothes and stuff and things like that. When there's also changing carpet, painting walls, changing out pieces of furniture. It's like in some ways, a whole renovation that happens to certain parts of the White House every time the president changes. So they're not just saying, all this guy and his family's clothes are leaving, all this guy and his family's clothes are coming. Sometimes rooms are completely redone. They have huge warehouses that have all these different pieces of furniture and memorabilia from various presidents. And any president that comes into the White House can request things from that warehouse that he wants to be in the White House when he's there. You can pick a chair that George Washington himself sat in that you want to be in the White House when you're in there. So there's so many logistics and so many things that happen. But the craziest part of all this is all of this switching out and changing and renovating and moving all has to happen within a span of 5 to 6 hours. When the outgoing president leaves for the swearing-in ceremony of the incoming president, the timer starts. And they have to get all of that done. It's hard enough for me to think about like painting one room in our house over the course of a few weeks, much less renovating the White House in a few hours. But all of this planning and preparation and moving and cleaning and construction for someone who most of the time ends up only living there for 4 years. And then you do it all over again the next 4 years, and then do it all over again the next 4 years. The work of the men and women that do these kinds of things in the White House, though unique in a lot of ways, it is actually a lot like the work you and I do day after day, week after week, in that it's not permanent. It's not going to last forever. It is temporary. But their work is also different from our work, not just because it's happening at the White House, but even more so because they know from day one the work they're doing is not going to last forever. As they're laying new carpet in the Oval Office, they know there's a very good chance 4 years from now they're going to have to come back in and replace it. As they're painting this room or bringing in this furniture, they know there's a very good chance 4 years from now they're going to have to come and do it all over again. But you and I often fail to have that kind of perspective when we think about our work, when we think about our toil, is the word he uses in Ecclesiastes, that is temporary. It doesn't last. It's not permanent. This is what Solomon calls himself, the preacher in Ecclesiastes. This is what he has learned, is learning as he writes this book, and this is what he wants us to learn in the way we think about our work as we go to the next part of Ecclesiastes here. And he's taking us through his own story of this quest for meaning in life, this quest for satisfaction in life. And so we saw a few weeks ago, he looked for meaning in wisdom and satisfaction in wisdom and knowledge, but that was a dead end. So then he looked for it in pleasure, experiencing all kinds of joys and happiness and highs that the world has to offer, but that also was a dead end. And today he's going to try work. He's going to try achievements. He's going to try productivity. But we're not just going to stop there, because through that, Solomon is going to take us through an experience to help us see bigger conclusions about this bigger picture in life. He's taking us to dead end, dead end, dead end, taking us to one more dead end, and then giving us a little peek, a little preview at some of the bigger truths that are happening here. If you've been with us through this study of the book and you've been waiting for some, even just a little bit rays of hope to show up in Ecclesiastes, today's your day. It's felt kind of gloomy, a little dark maybe at times, but there's some rays of hope showing up today. And there's going to be a challenging perspective change for all of us to see things differently, to see ourselves differently, to see life differently, most of all, to see the Lord differently than maybe we do. So that's how we're going to work through this. We're going to see work rightly, see ourselves rightly, see the Lord rightly. And so what Solomon's taking us through on this short little part of the book, we're looking at chapter 2 and then part of chapter 3, is he's starting down low and then zooming up and out as we go through a few sections here. So let's jump up. Let's jump to the first one, seeing work rightly. Seeing our work, our toil, our productivity, our achievements rightly. We pick up right where I started just a minute ago in verse 18 with some sobering reality check type thoughts from the preacher. Here's what he says. Let's jump back and see verse 18. He writes, "I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he'll be master of all for which I've toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity." So Solomon is still on this search for meaning, a search for something that is going to relieve the burden of living life in a fallen world. And this search has brought him to the conclusion that his work, his great achievements are not the answer because they don't last. But it's important to see here that his words aren't ultimately about his work. His words are ultimately about himself. Look again at verse 18, how he talks about himself in this verse. "I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me." That phrase at the end there, "who will come after me," is the part I want us to zoom in on for a second. He says, my work is not going to last because I'm not going to last. My work is not permanent. My achievements are not permanent because my own life is not permanent. What he's coming face to face with here is the reality of his own death, the inevitable conclusion to his own life. And it changes his perspective on his achievements in life and everything that he's pursuing. He switches from seeing all his work and all his achievements as this monument of stone for him to be remembered forever, to now he sees them in light of his own death more as just a tower of bubbles that will eventually just pop and be forgotten. There's no security in holding on to your work and holding on to your achievements because there's no satisfaction, because there's no permanence. This bothers him, and it frustrates him. He says in verse 18, "I hated all my toil when I realized this." And it should bother us too. We should feel what he feels, because you and I are all born with this built-in longing for something that keeps going. We're all built with this longing for something that lasts, for something that doesn't fade away. And he can't reach this yet. He can't find this yet. And so it leads him to say this in verse 20. He says, "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. And this also is vanity." He keeps repeating, this is vanity. This is vanity, meaning this is empty. This is short-lived. This is not permanent. This is not what I'm after. It was another dead end. And then he comes to the ultimate question in verse 22. Pay close attention to this question. "What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun?" This is really similar to the question he opened the whole book with in chapter 1, verse 3. He says, "What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun?" And he's asking it again, what am I gaining? What am I really keeping from all this work that I'm doing? What's really sticking with me? What's really permanent? There's nothing that's lasting. He's saying you can work your whole life. You can build up all kinds of wealth. You can earn awards. You can be recognized as one of the top people in your field, but none of that can make you matter, because none of that can give you lasting meaning in life. There's going to be a time where you retire. There's going to be a time where you die, and there might even be a building named after you, but it's only a generation later people show up and see the name on that building. Who was that? And then go on about their day. But what the preacher says next should sound really surprising, because it's felt like minor key, minor key, minor key, minor key. Now you're going to hear a little note of a major. This is one of those rays of hope that I'm talking about. But let's take it in the flow of what he's already said. Verse 24, chapter 2, verse 24. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw. What has he said this whole book up leading up to this point? This I saw is vanity. This I saw is vanity. This I saw is vanity. Over and over and over. But right here, this also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? If you're just reading it in the flow of the book, you get to this part and you're thinking, who's talking now? Who is this? Someone else grabbed the pen from the preacher and started writing. They said, dude, you're a little too dark. You're a little too sad. You talk about death a lot. Let me just put the word joy in this book one time to help people come up for air a little bit. But it's the same deal. And he's talking about enjoyment. And we're starting to see the conclusions that he's beginning to come to after all this searching that he's done. Wisdom, no. Pleasure, no. Work, no. But he's beginning to come to these conclusions because he's seen death puts limits on my life. Death puts limits on the things I pursue in my life. So those things can't give me meaning because they can't change reality. They can't keep me from dying. But now he actually puts a limit on death. When he says, there's nothing better than a person just eat, drink, find enjoyment in your work. And this is from the hand of God, because without God, who can eat? And without God, who can have enjoyment? When you and I accept the fact, not just, oh yeah, I know I'm going to die one day, but I mean like genuinely sit down, maybe actually have some serious thought about it. When we accept the fact that we will die one day, it stops us from expecting too much from good things in life. We learn to see those good things as good gifts from God, not something that can make us ultimately happy. Death gives a complete perspective shift. Wisdom and pleasure and work, all these things that are good gifts from God, they're actually ruined when we try to use them to get meaning and satisfaction and happiness. But acknowledging our own mortality helps us see all the different things in the world and say, that can be a good thing, and I should thank God for that thing, but it can't be ultimate. It helps us look at the things in the world and say, I can enjoy that good meal. I can enjoy the work God has given me to do. I can enjoy the things that bring me happiness and laughter in this life, but I can't get meaning from them because they're not permanent. We embrace life under the sun without trying to make life under the sun do for us what only God can do for us. And when we think that way, we start to realize there's nothing better than we eat and we drink and we find enjoyment in the season of life God has put us in, knowing that joy can only come from him. We have to receive all these things as gifts from God, the friendships you have, the job you have, the school you go to, the family that you have, the things, the hobbies that you enjoy, the things that you have in your pantry, the house or apartment or wherever that you live in, these are all good gifts from God. And he's the one that makes enjoyment of them possible. He gives us the ability to enjoy these gifts by giving us a different kind of perspective on ourselves. Not just seeing our work rightly, but also seeing ourselves rightly. That's the next part here. And this is where we start to zoom out a little bit from just wisdom, pleasure, work, fill in the blank of whatever it is. We start to zoom out to say, all right, now let's see ourselves rightly. Let's see ourselves rightly. I think Solomon's realization of how short life is and how life will inevitably end is what leads to this famous poem at the beginning of chapter 3. You might have heard this poem at a wedding or at a funeral, or in a song. But keep in mind that one of the ways, as we look at this poem, keep in mind that one of the ways God leads us to know him is by helping us to know ourselves. Because we begin to see things about the Lord when we see things about ourselves that are right and true. Here's the, Here's what he says, chapter 3, verse 1. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. Stop right there for a second. He gives us the purpose of this poem he's about to tell us. To tell us that in everything in life, there's a season for it. There's a chapter for it. There's a time for every matter under heaven. Now, if you just scan, I'll read it here in a second, but if you just scan down through verses 2 through 8 in your Bible, what's the word that you see repeated over and over and over and over and over? Time. Good. So you can see the preacher's wisdom here. He has just finished emphasizing the benefit of embracing our humanity, of acknowledging our limitations, accepting the reality of our death. And what he's doing is he disillusions us to bring us back to reality. This poem, this whole book is kind of like a shaking of us to say, hey, wake up. You can't live in a make-believe world. And as he walks through this, he's bringing us to the real world. And then one of the best ways to do that is to think about time. And what he does in these verses is he shares this observation to point out that God has created the world in a certain way. And in the way that God has created the world, there's certain seasons. I don't mean just winter, spring, summer, fall. I mean there's inevitable changes in life, and there's opposites that we all experience and go through in life. Let's look at verse 2, and you'll see how he says it. There is a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. You'll notice here that what's meant to be represented by this poem is just a wide, comprehensive view of life on earth. It's meant to represent everything from beginning to end and what life under the sun entails. It's not just all highs. It's not just all lows. It's not just all big events. It's not just all small daily details. It is all of these things. And as you read through this poem, you'll notice there's not really a specific sequence or pattern, at least not one that I can pick up on anyways. It seems kind of random. It doesn't seem to go in any particular order. And I actually think that's part of the point. Because all of these seasons are out of our control. We don't plan them. We don't schedule them. We can't look at our week and say, okay, this week, the week of January 26th, I would like a little bit time to break down, a little bit time to build up. Only 20 minutes of mourning on Tuesday, and then the rest of the week to be a time to dance. We don't get to plan our week like that. It doesn't work. Oftentimes, these different seasons, these different times happen to us. We don't make them happen. That you can be the best in your skill, you can have the hardest working work ethic of anyone around you, but no amount of work can change the seasons of life that we're in. He's using this poem, I think, to explain some key truths about us as humans, that these two things to help us see ourselves. We live in a world that we did not create, and we live in a world that we do not control. And you think, well, those are two of the most basic observations I've ever heard in my entire life. It's true, but you and I, day after day, live like, in different ways, those two things are not true. That we live in a world of our own making, and that there are things we can control. Now, I'm not here to say that we're all robots. I don't think that's the case. I think the Lord does give us the ability to make decisions and to take action and to think and to ask questions and to seek those things out. But in the big picture of things, we live in a world that we did not create, and we live in a world that we do not control. Life has a beginning, life has an end, and all the seasons in between are determined by the God who created the world that we live this life in. We are creatures. We are bound by time. We are limited in what we control, in what we can control. We live in a constantly changing world. The seasons of our lives are constantly changing. None of it is permanent. which is why you cannot achieve lasting success, which is why you cannot find lasting satisfaction from anything in life under the sun. It's always changing. None of it is meant to last. You can chase after greatness. You can look all over the world for gain. But verses like this show us that we are simply, you and I right now, are simply part of the generation who came after the last one and comes before the next one. That's who we are. So I'd like to just pause here for a second before we go to the next part of chapter 3 and just give us all some space to think, is this how we see ourselves? Do we have this kind of down-to-earth, biblically shaped view of ourselves? The areas of life that you may not see yourself this way would be to think about, what are the areas of life you're trying to control? What are the areas of life you're trying to just grab onto and make it in a way different than what it is? What are areas of life that you need to surrender to the Lord? Trust His control. Trust His plan. Knowing that we actually can trust His plan and can trust His control because of the very last thing that we're going to see here in chapter 3. So we're seeing work rightly. We're seeing ourselves rightly. Lastly, keep zooming out. Last part here, seeing God rightly. Seeing God rightly. Solomon returns to talking about work again, to talking about toil. And he's going to repeat his main question. We saw it in chapter 1. We saw it in chapter 2. It comes up again here in chapter 3. And it comes to us in verse 9. Look there with me. Chapter 3, verse 9. What gain has the worker from his toil? There's a question again. What gain? What are we gaining? What are we benefiting from? What are we keeping from any of the work that we do? He is still seeking a genuine answer to that question. He's saying, if life is short, if death is certain, if seasons of life always change and nothing we chase after in this world will fully satisfy us, then what is the point of anything that we're doing? What do we gain? What do we add? And each step that he takes us through in this book, he's developing the answer. And he gives us a little bit of clarity here in verse 10. Here's what he says in verse 10. I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Verse 11 is one of the most important verses in the entire book of Ecclesiastes. It gives us a truth about God that is very key and a truth about ourselves that is very key, and they're meant to go together. And they bring us one step closer, not the full journey, but one step closer to finding this kind of meaning and satisfaction in life that Solomon is after. First, the truth about God. He says in verse 11, He has made everything beautiful in its time. There's that word time again. We just heard a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, time, time, time. And now he says that God has made everything beautiful in its time. Meaning God is working all things toward a specific goal. God has a specific end in mind, and the Lord is putting together a masterpiece in the story of this world, and it will come about according to His timing. What looks to me and you like constantly changing seasons, born, die, plant, pluck up, kill, heal, break down, build up, what looks to us like these constantly random changing seasons, from the Lord's perspective, is the outworking of His eternal perfect plan in the world. He has made everything beautiful in its time. But then on the other side of that same coin, he says about us, also, this is the middle of verse 11, also God has put eternity into our hearts. God has put eternity into our hearts. What does that mean? We're saying you and I were meant to live forever. You and I were made for what is permanent. You and I are made for what lasts. We were created with a longing to last and a longing to matter. And it's this desire
that sent the preacher on this journey to begin with. He just couldn't name it at the time. And the reality is, simple answers won't satisfy. Answers from the world won't satisfy. I would even say shallow religious answers won't satisfy. Only God himself will satisfy. Truly knowing God himself. That the very reason that you and I chase after the wind, as Solomon calls it, the reason that you run after knowledge and wisdom in whatever form you do, the reason that you and I run after pleasure in whatever form you and I do, the reason we chase after achievements, this is the reason. Because you and I were created with eternity in our hearts, we just haven't found where to find it yet, but he's saying, I'm telling you where to find it. And nothing in this world is going to show it to you. I think it's helpful to pause here again and just see the flow of thought that the preacher is giving us. We have seen God is working all things according to an eternal perfect plan. We are seeing that we are made for eternity and we have desires that only can be satisfied by God. But here's the deal though. We find ourselves in life under the sun, bound by time, in a broken world, cursed by sin. How does all that fit together? If it was just, hey, God's gonna make everything beautiful, you were made for something eternal, just come to God. Well, that sounds great, except for I got this really hard work situation right now, or I got this really hard family situation or friend difficulty, or I'm just very lost in what I'm supposed to do in life, or I have to take a next step, but I don't know what that looks like, so I need an anchor point for that. Well, here's what he says, the last part of verse 11. He's put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. There's a limit to what we can know. The eternity that God has put in our hearts gives us a longing to know what God has done from the start to the finish, but we can't know what God knows. We can't see what God sees. We can't do what God does, and so we don't have the view of the big picture that he has. Life keeps changing, but God never changes. Life is temporary, but God is eternal. Life under the sun is out of our control, but that doesn't mean it's completely out of control. It's just out of our control. It's completely under his control. Here's how these things, I think, come together. It was said much better than I could ever say it by David Gibson. I will probably quote him once a week as we go through this book because he wrote a book on Ecclesiastes that is phenomenal. Super easy to read. Would highly recommend it to you. It's called Living Life Backwards. Living Life Backwards. Here's what he says in his book about bringing all this together. Because God lives forever and I will not, I can experience the different times of my life knowing they are part of a bigger picture that I cannot see, but which is visible to a good and wise God who sees the whole as beautiful. So right now it may feel like, Lord, I'm only in a time to weep. And he's saying, but when we realize God lives forever and we don't, we realize God sees that time to weep and from a different perspective than you and I see it. He sees a bigger picture that is beautiful. One different author that I was reading this week said in a way that I think is really, really good. He said, ultimately, when it comes to God and to the times and seasons of our lives, we are all like ants crawling across an iPad. You think about that picture for a second. What an ant sees if it walks across the iPad. It sees something colorful and maybe pretty incredible, but can only see a tiny little bit of the iPad. But you and I hold it and we see the whole picture and how it all fits together. This is the very difference between our perspective and the Lord's perspective when we look at our lives. The message of Ecclesiastes is not, life is full of good times, life's full of bad times, just roll with the punches. That's not the message of the book. The message of the book is that life is full of good times, life is full of hard times that we cannot control, but we can trust they are part of a bigger pattern that our good and powerful and wise God controls. At the end of the preacher's search for life and happiness and meaning, he discovers that it doesn't actually come from his searching. He discovers that it doesn't actually come from his striving. He discovers that it doesn't actually come from his chasing. It comes from God's giving. We don't start in the world and then move up to the Lord. We start with who God is. We more clearly see who we are, and that shapes everything about work and wisdom and pleasure and eating and drinking and everything God has given us to do in this life under the sun. So instead of fearing poverty and chasing after success, instead of fearing loneliness and chasing after pleasure or escape, instead of fearing being foolish and chasing after books and wisdom and knowledge, the preacher would tell us right now, for this point in the book, fear and trust the Lord and enjoy what he has given you as good gifts from him that were never meant to replace him, but were only meant to point you to him.